This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The popular NBC series Third Rock from the Sun ended its long run last month after 6 years on the air. My guest John Lithgow starred as an alien from another planet who has come here to secretly investigate the customs of Earthlings while posing as university professor Dick Solomon. Now Lithgow is the voice of the villainous Lord Farquaad in the animated film Shrek. Lithgow first became known for his starring roles in such films as Blowout, The World According to Garp, Twilight Zone the Movie, and Terms of Endearment, and for his acclaimed performance in the Broadway show M. Butterfly. He's added a new audience to his following, kids. He's the author of two children's books, The Remarkable Farkle McBride, which was a bestseller, and a new one called Marsupial Sue, which comes out this fall. The books grew out of concerts Lithgow's been giving for kids, featuring him singing with an orchestra. He has a new CD for kids called Farkle and Friends. I asked him how his concert career got started.
I've been doing concerts for kids literally as long as I've had my own kids, which makes it 30 years now. I used to just play the guitar. In fact, I taught myself the guitar when I had a baby. I loved the idea of playing for him. I've always played in kids' classrooms and assemblies and benefits. And in the last couple of years, well, I was asked to do a CD for Sony, Singing in the Bathtub, and about half the songs on that had a big band jazz orchestra background. And it just occurred to me that this was great stuff for a big hall, big orchestra concert for kids. So I just started calling people, saying them I would send them my CD and offered my services. I called the New York Pops, who play at Carnegie Hall, because purely out of vanity, I loved the idea of debuting at Carnegie Hall. And they said yes, and I was off. I'm not the greatest singer in the world, but I have wonderful musical backup. It's not something that a lot of people are doing, and I remembered when I was a kid, people did it.
Are you an alum of the Bernstein Young People's Concerts?
Yes, those, but much more Danny Kaye entertaining kids. He's the one I remember. I remember him clowning around for kids in a big hall, and that's kind of how I imagined myself.
Let's play a song from your new CD, Farkle and Friends, that shows how you're using your voice and how you're using the orchestra. And this is called The Bandshell Right Next to the Zoo. You wrote the lyric to this.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Elliott, the band leader, wrote the music.
Uh-huh.
Tell us something about this before we hear it.
Well, we were doing a recording session for another song, and I heard the oboe player cleaning out his reed, and it made this wild squawk like a peacock. And I suddenly had this notion. The animals play the instruments. And I cooked up this story of a little boy at an outdoor concert next to the zoo falling asleep and dreaming that the animals break out of their cages and play the instruments. That was the genesis of it, just from that one squawk. So often with these songs, I try to find some oblique way of showing off the orchestra, sort of giving them a little guide to the orchestra, a little music education without them knowing it.
So this is John Lithgow with Bill Elliott and his orchestra from the CD Farkle and Friends, The Bandshell Right Next to the Zoo.
The bison played bass and the monkey the fiddle. The yak played the saxophone right in the middle. The camel played clarinet, the ferret, the flute. While the hippo had chosen the tuba to toot. Siberian tigers, Mongolian goats, a superabundance of bestial notes. Oh, children, remember, whatever you may do, never play music right next to the zoo. They'll burst from their cages.
That's John Lithgow from his new CD, Farkle and Friends, and he wrote the lyric to that song. Now, the movie that you're in now is a movie that's being enjoyed both by adults and children, Shrek, the animated film, which is currently showing. I want you to describe your character of Lord Farquaad for our listeners who haven't yet seen it.
Lord Farquaad is Well, he suffers from something of a Napoleon complex. He's a small man with a very grandiose self-image. And that's kind of the central joke of his character. So they hired a well-known tall actor for the part. Basically, I was hired for my tall voice. And he's a completely repellent villain. I mean, he's one of the most odious, but he's very funny. So that slightly redeems him.
I want to play a clip from the movie in which you are torturing a gingerbread man and dismembering him as you're torturing him, trying to get him to talk.
Yes.
Here's the clip.
Ahem. Run, run, run as fast as you can. You can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man.
You're a monster.
I'm not the monster here. You are. You and the rest of that fairy tale trash poisoning my perfect world. Now tell me, where are the others?
Eat me!
I've tried to be fair to you creatures. Now my patience has reached its end. Tell me, or I'll...
No, not the buttons! Not my gumdrop buttons!
All right, then. Who's hiding them?
Okay, I'll tell you. Do you know the Muffin Man?
The Muffin Man?
The Muffin Man.
Yes, I know the Muffin Man. Who lives on Drury Lane?
It's our little homage to Marathon Man.
Well, John Lithgow, tell me about developing the villain voice for this.
Well, it was kind of my stock in trade villain voice. I mean, there's a lot of cliffhanger and, you know, it's very kind of loose and improvisational, the process. We sort of created the voice as we went along. In fact, they somewhat changed the concept of Lord Farquaad over the years. You know, we started on this like 4 years ago. And even as we did it, we would do every line three or four different ways and to give them lots of choices to string it all together.
Do you have to do that because it's animated and when you're recording the voice, the animation isn't done yet?
Yeah. The animation comes after. They animate to you. So these recording sessions are extremely important. It must be a wonderful process for them. It's something like acting, I guess, to get all these choices. And, you know, the actors are in they record the actors separately, too.
So you're doing your lines by yourself?
Yeah. I was never with any of these actors. So they get to do the timing themselves, the comedy timing. And they're so very good at it. I mean, this is something that actors are accustomed to doing, and they're very proud of themselves. You know, they think this is what we do. Well, the animators were incredibly skillful.
Now, did the to what extent do you think the animators try to take inspiration from the actors' actual faces?
Oh, it's very important to them. They had a video camera trained on us at all times. And in fact, I think on their computer screens up there in their studio, they could just punch up the actor speaking the lines at any time. They know that the voice is much more than just a voice. It's the whole face, and it's even the body language. So in a very creepy way, Lord Farquaad, I think, does resemble me.
My guest is actor John Lithgow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Lithgow is my guest. He's one of the stars of Shrek. He also has a new children's book called Marsupial Sue that's coming out in September, and a new CD called Farco and Friends. Let's talk a little bit about how you started acting, which was very, very young, because your father founded a series of regional Shakespeare festivals around the country.
That's right.
So how old were you when he started doing the Shakespeare festivals?
He started his first Shakespeare festival in 51 when I was five or six, at Antioch in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And that ran on for about 8 years, and it was like my summer camp. I and my sister and brother, we would just always be around, hanging around and befriending the actors, watching the rehearsals. We even played, you know, the Prince in the Tower and the fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream. It was really very exotic, a kind of wonderful, arty, campy life. And it was all outdoors in small town Ohio. So it was a wonderful combination of it was kind of a cross between Tom Sawyer and, I don't know, Dick Whittington.
know? well, at the age when most kids are watching Bugs Bunny cartoons and things like that, you're involved in the Shakespearean productions. How was, for instance, the story of Hamlet explained to you when you were a child?
I don't think anybody sat me down and explained a thing. I just sort of got it by osmosis. They are great stories.
Did you think of the stage as a place where stories that seemed really interesting but you couldn't quite understand were enacted because it was Shakespearean language that was kind of out of your reach?
Well, when I was in Midsummer Night's Dream playing Mustard Seed, one of the fairies, I guess I was about 7 years old, and I remember the language just washing over me. I mean, this was such a, you know, on these balmy Ohio nights, hearing Titania and Oberon argue about the changeling boy, you know. I remember rehearsing some Shakespearean comedy or something, and it was in the rehearsing the first act, and the director saying, "Oh, this is the part where nobody knows what's going on. Nobody understands anything. You just get through it briskly. They'll understand it later." And I that really did stick in my mind as an important lesson. With something like Shakespeare, I think it's very important to have a nice long attention span when it comes to really any art. Same certainly for orchestral music, you know. You've got to give things a chance to unfold and not panic. I'm not getting this. I remember seeing Peter Brook's great production of Midsummer Night's Dream in the White Box, which was electrifying. The Demetrius, Helena, Hermia, Lysander, the lovers who are going through all their troubles in the first scene with Theseus, he had them simply stand in front of the audience and just speak. Ben Kingsley was one of those. He was Demetrius. Simply saying the lines right out to the audience. It's like, don't even pretend for this to be real. This is where we lay out the story. And then, bit by bit, the show took on human form. I'm not sure, you know, that can be abused, but it was a wonderful direct way of saying, here's the groundwork. This, you know, you will go with the story now.
Are there any Shakespearean roles you'd particularly like to do as an adult?
Yes. I want to play King Lear eventually, now that I'm old enough to play it, but not too old that I won't have the strength for it. So sometime in the next 10 years, I'd love to play King Lear. Curiously, I've done almost no Shakespeare as a professional actor. I've done two not very good productions back in the 70s, but I was in 20 productions of Shakespeare before I was 20 years old. But I'm kind of picky. I tend to be very skeptical about I'm not a fan of bad Shakespeare, and there's an awful lot of that put on. I don't particularly want to be the best thing in it. You know?
Now, let me skip ahead to something that everybody knows you for now, which mm-hmm. is Third Rock.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about the series being over? Are you sad, or is it part of relief to go on to other things?
Well, it's very sad. It was intensely sad when it ended. I mean, we shot the finale episode in January. It aired in May. And we were, you know, you've never seen such tears and hugs. I mean, 6 years is the longest job, you know, six times as long as the longest job I'd done up until then. Very close, all of us. We all loved each other and loved working with each other. And it was an incredibly creative, fun process doing that sitcom. We did 138 episodes. And doing even one of those episodes is a ball. You're just spending the whole week laughing, figuring out how to make other people laugh. And it's, you know, it's very sad to see that come to an end. I mean, the interesting thing about doing a sitcom is you're creating from whole cloth and you're very much a part of the creative process.
Oh, really? Because I thought in a way you get your script to show up and you do
it. Not at all. Mm-hmm. I would say Third Rock changed my life because I was so much a creative player. I was so much a part of the process. I began to see acting in a different way.
How?
It's the collaboration with the writers. It's a medium that's so driven by the actors and the writers. And when they are working happily together, it all works. Because the actor's job is to give the writers their, you know, give the writing its every chance. They give you a script, you rehearse it full out. So whatever doesn't work, they know about it right away and they can go rewrite it. And your job is basically a negative one. You give it all you've got and you say, you know what, this scene just isn't playing. Something more has got to happen here. Something, I don't learn anything from this moment. Or what, you know, we have to create a crisis here in order for it to be resolved. You know, just asking all these basic questions.
When you were considering whether or not to take the part on Third Rock, did your actor friends have advice for you about how TV would affect your career, for better or for worse?
Well, the only actor I actually consulted about it was John Mahoney on Frasier. And he said, you will love this process. This is theater. It's not TV. It's not movie. This is like theater. You rehearse. You rewrite. You have a supercharged audience. You'll just have a great time. I would say most other people were gravely skeptical. You know, I said yes to Third Rock, and then it was about 2 years before it was actually on the air. And during those two years. Early on, I would say, oh, yeah, I have this fantastic series. I play this alien who's on a mission to investigate Earth, and he doesn't know what's going on, but he's very broadly. And they would look at me like they would sort of smile and say, uh-huh. But early on, I realized they thought I was nuts, So I tended to stop overselling it.
John Lithgow is my guest, and now he has a new children's book, which is called Marsupial Sue. It will be published in September, and he has a new CD called Farkle and Friends, in which he sings some classic kids' songs and some classic kind of novelty songs and some original songs as well. Next spring, you will be starring in a new Broadway musical adaptation of the classic film, The Sweet Smell of Success.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, Burt Lancaster played this mean and kind of bitter, malicious gossip columnist named J.J. Hunsaker. And that's the part that you're taking.
That's right.
And in the movie, Tony Curtis played a press agent who's always trying to get his stories planted in Hunsaker's column. And they have a kind of interesting relationship.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this musical. The screenplay was by Ernest Lehman and Clifford Odets.
Correct.
Who wrote the play? Who's doing the music?
The book has been adapted by John Guare. And the music is written by Marvin Hamlisch and the lyrics by a brilliant lyricist named Craig Carnelia. And Nicholas Heitner is directing it. And Christopher Wheeldon, this great young New York City ballet choreographer, is choreographing it. We did it last July in workshop in New York, a 6-week-long workshop. I mean, we really worked in great detail and only performed it 3 times for 150 people each. So I am emboldened to say it really is a great piece of work. I've done it. You know, it's nice to go into a project having already performed it.
How many times had you seen the movie?
I'd seen it a couple of times, and I saw it again, of course, while we were doing it. It's similar in tone, but very different in many ways. They've done a brilliant job structuring it. If you remember the film sort of begins at a crisis point in the relationship between J.J. and Sydney. Well, the play begins with J.J. and Sydney meeting. So in a way, the musical is about the seduction and fall of Sidney Falco. You know, you wonder, how in the world do they make a musical of this? Well, in all sorts of extremely ingenious ways. Hunsaker is loosely based on Walter Winchell. They went back to the interesting fact that Walter Winchell started life as a vaudevillian. So my big number is J.J. Hunsaker's great old vaudeville act, which he dusts off at a charity telethon. Huh. He sings and dances while some horrible stuff is going on around him, which he himself has put into motion. It's kind of, it has the sort of bitter, almost Brechtian power of cabaret.
Well, I wish you really good luck with Sweet Smell of Success and with all your children's concerts and books and CDs and everything.
Thank you.
Really a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
That's great, Terry. Thank you so much.
John Lithgow is the voice of the villainous Lord Farquaad in Shrek. His new children's book, Marsupial Sue, will be published this September. He also has a new CD of children's songs called Farkle and Friends. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.